Welcome to the August Citizens Climate Lobby call. If you're new to Citizens Climate Lobby, my name is Mark Reynolds. If you're new to CCL again, especially we want to welcome you. We added new chapters in Minnesota and South Carolina in the US. We added 4 new chapters in India since last month's call, and also one in Tokyo, Japan. What's going to be happening today is in just a moment, I'm going to be introducing our guest speaker, who we're very excited to have here. After that, I'll be going over what we recommend that you do this month. And then kind of painting a picture of what's going to be happening between now and the end of the year as we do everything we can to make sure that a price on carbon is part of any climate package next year. You know, there's a Willie Nelson song where he says, "My heroes have always been cowboys." In this organization, our heroes are scientists, and particularly they're climate scientists. We do what we do because the climate scientists tell us we must. We work to put a price on carbon and give it back to households. The most recent IPCC assessment says that we must reaffirm that a price must be put in place. And the largest signing statement in the history of American economists, over 3,000 economists, say putting a price on carbon, remitting the money back to households is really good thing to do, including 27 Nobel laureates and 3 living former vice Fed chairs. So we do what the solution we do because of the economists tell us we must. And then the social scientist also says that you must lead with solutions. 2011 is when Rob Willers first published "Apocalypse Soon: Dire Messages Are Counterproductive on Global Warming." And there's really been a lot of affirmation in the social scientist that we want to lead with solutions. So we're a science-based organization. We're a climate change organization. And as I said, climate scientists are always been our heroes. This particular climate scientist, Dr. Kim Cobb, is a professor at School of Earth and Atmospheric at the Sciences of Georgia Tech. She's also been peer-reviewed, published over 100 times, and has her PhD from Scripps Institute of Oceanography, which from our view is the most important scientific organization we work with. That's why we were so thrilled to win the Keeling Curve Prize this year. So it ends up that our Vice President of Government Affairs, Dr. Danny Richter, and Dr. Cobb both had the same advisor at Scripps. And we've been really thrilled with everything Danny's done for us. But according to Danny, that advisor considers Dr. Cobb as the real star of that program. So Dr. Kim Cobb, thank you so much for making yourself available on Saturday in August. It's really great to have you here.
Well, it's really, really great to be here, Mark. Thanks so much to everybody for making this possible. And I'm so excited to share a little bit of my research today with you, but really spend most of the time talking about what Mark was already talking about all of those solutions that we're going to need to grab and build and grow very, very urgently over the next 10 or 20 years. So I'm seeking to be part of all of that, and I'm proud to call all of you the family of folks that, as I know, working day in, day out on that as well. So here to share some stories from the Pacific and the front lines in Georgia, both of them very, very important. So let me get my slide shared here if I can. Let's see, I think that's gonna work. Okay, fabulous. Can you guys see those? Okay, great. So obviously wouldn't be a climate science talk if I didn't start out with one of the most iconic images from our entire field. My colleague Ed Hopkins really put together this image of the warming stripes, which has really captured the public imagination and also is a beautiful reminder to me on a daily basis of where we are and where we need to go and the choices that we have. You guys probably have always, you know, seen this. This is not probably new to you, but what you may not have seen is the next image, which is going back, taking the warming stripes back 2,000 years, which is something that is very fond for me because that is the time frame that I study as a paleoclimate scientist, studying in particular the evolution of temperature extremes over the last millennia or two, how they're changing today and what they mean for our future. And so this is something that I show the public on a regular basis and kind of blows your mind how hard we had to work to get this data set. This is Pages 2K related data. If you want to Google it, it's hundreds of scientists, thousands of records going into this paleo temperature record, and really brings into stark contrast where we are today. So my past research, as Mark alluded to, really began in oceanography at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And I got my degree in the early 2000s. And so I've been working in the Pacific Ocean in particular, looking at the evolution of ocean temperature extremes through present, in fact. But 2016 marked a very strong pivot away from a climate researcher 100% of the time, if you will, to a climate researcher that is very devoted to searching out and scaling climate solutions in my home state of Georgia. So I'll talk a little bit about that transformation, what motivated it, and where I am on that journey, and I hope we have a lot of time for discussions. So my journey really began in the tropical Pacific as a climate scientist, and this is a picture of me doing one of my favorite things, scuba diving in the deep tropical Pacific, and then pulling out a coral core, which in my thesis and my work thus far, we've used these coral cores to understand the history of El Nino events, which are natural warming excursions and extremes that occur in the tropical Pacific, and they have global impact. And so understanding the history of El Nino events is locked into these coral cores, helps us understand the nature, frequency, and magnitude of past extremes and whether they're changing today. And so this is one of the more Indiana Jones moments of my research and something that strongly attracted me to this field. And one of the culminations of this research, which is published last year by my student Pamela Groth, that really documents for one of the first times, especially from the middle of the Pacific like this, that the corals are telling us that El Niños are getting stronger over the last decades compared to a very long pre-industrial baseline. And so with that evidence in hand, I kind of am scratching the surface of one of the most pressing research questions in all of climate science, having to do with this global temperature extreme and all of the havoc that it wrecks on temperature and rainfall and even storm tracks and storm intensities all over the world. So this is kind of a crowning achievement of my lab and was just recently published, built off decades of work. And El Niños come and go quite frequently, and this is the dates showing you the history of El Niño events, and this is a map which indicates the extent of warming that occurs during El Niño temperature extreme, and as you can see, it crosses most of the central to eastern equatorial Pacific. And the last big one was in 2016. And when I say it was a big one, I mean it was probably the strongest on record by many metrics. And it really had a strong impact on my research site in the middle of the Pacific. And as I'll discuss, a very strong impact on myself and my vision for my future role in climate science. So going back to my research hat, this is me scuba diving on a very incredible remote Pacific reef of Christmas Island, which is smack in the middle of the Pacific. And I'm installing a temperature logger in 2014 that is going to help us record what we know is going to be a coming El Niño extreme that was going to unfold in 2015 and 2016. So I'm happily installing a temperature sensor. I'm so excited that this El Niño is going to come and give me the opportunity of a lifetime as a scientist to really witness in person and collect all these data sets of how this El Niño event was going to impact my site. Fast forward a year or so, and we really had the worst case scenario at Christmas Island. This is a picture of the same exact reef after 10 or more months of record-breaking temperatures, far past the threshold for coral bleaching, and in fact, way into the zone of coral mortality. And so this reef is a dead reef. This is taken in April 2016 at the tail end of what was a mega El Niño event. And obviously 85% mortality documented at this reef. Very few living corals survived this event. And so this is one of the occasions in one's life when you have a chance to reflect. April 2016 was bad enough, but I returned to the site in November 2016, and I was on Christmas Island when we elected this current administration, and I was diving on the dead reefs and looking what was going on back home and trying to make sense of where we were. And I came to the really sudden and crippling realization that we weren't where we thought we were. We were never where I thought we were. It was never going to be enough what was ever going to happen in DC. I placed all my eggs in this basket of another winner, and that had failed miserably. And I really had to come to grips with the fact that my research was not going to be enough. And eyewitness reports from the 2016 El Nino event really continued to pour in across not just our research site, but across the Great Barrier Reef, the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic, Hawaii. It would be the most widespread coral bleaching and mortality event ever on record. And of course, we've seen the headlines in recent years. We know this is not going away. We know corals are on the front lines of climate change. We know there will be a fundamental reshaping of the distribution of living reefs in our lifetime. It's already underway. And so this is something, as a coral reef researcher, that hits very close to home and reminds me, with all of those horrible headlines, how much work we have to do and what's at risk in terms of the natural environment. So in terms of going all in for climate solutions, I wanted to take a quick run through some of the things that have happened since 2016, when I was grappling for a way forward as a scientist, and knowing that I had some unique skills, but also noting that I had to bring this into my own life in a very daily way that was going to remind me that I can be part of it on a daily basis, and as well as a professional basis. So here's a quick snapshot. In 2017, I started biking to work. It's been something that I've loved ever since. I spent 14 years in a tin can, as bicyclists like to call cars. But I love my bike, and I've been really enjoying sharing it with my family. I have four children. They bike to school. And then, as you can see down the list here, we just got solar a couple years ago, a culmination of a big dream for me. Flying less has become a big part of my life. Before everybody was grounded in 2020, I grounded myself in 2020 as part of a personal and professional experiment. And then trees and LEDs, all the things that you probably know and love. And I wanted to flag those things which have illustrated for me the really firm ties between the individual choices and the collective structural changes that we know need to occur in order for climate solutions to really scale. And that would be the biking to work, which really unveiled for me that I could get involved with city level planning and work with my council member and my neighborhood association, where I hold an elected office, to work on bike and pedestrian infrastructure. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but these are places where I have taken a step at an individual level and then opened up a vista for broader collective action. So this is not a lesson that I could have foreseen, and I'm always wondering what's next on this path for myself. Now, speaking of the broader landscape of climate change, you know, the Southeast is in the bullseye of climate change impacts. And many of you already know this. This is a map of projected economic losses across the United States by the Brookings Institution. And the broad swath of red across the Southeast is really indicating acute vulnerability and many low income, historically marginalized, often communities of color, who will bear the brunt of impacts like heat waves, reductions in the labor force caused by heat extremes and precipitation extremes, flooding, for example. But also, you can see it's not just confined to the coastal areas. It really is across the entire southeastern region. And so in Georgia, I also have a unique opportunity to think about what adaptation and mitigation means in Georgia. And in this role, I'm very happy to hold a position as director of the Global Change Program at Georgia Tech, where I can actually get a paycheck for thinking about this on a daily basis now, rather than writing a bazillion coral-related grants to NSF. And now I'm working with students and researchers across campus to stitch together large-scale climate programs. One of the ones which I'm most excited about is called Drawdown Georgia. I'm not going to talk too much about it here, but it's a year-old initiative funded by the Ray C. Anderson Foundation, and it really seeks to roadmap carbon neutrality in Georgia by 2030, borrowing from the amazing work that Project Drawdown delivered to the research community in terms of digging into which solutions make sense in Georgia, using a portion of their solutions and also adding some of our own. So this is led by Dr. Marilyn Brown at Georgia Tech, and it's runs across Georgia Tech, University of Georgia, and Emory as part of a broader project called the Georgia Climate Project. And this is the website up there. You can check it out. We're seeking to build a consortium across the academic sector to really advance climate solutions across Georgia. So really homegrown stuff, but we're making deep headway with this project. Again, I don't want to go into any of the solutions here, but please reach out over email if you're interested in learning more. And we have a bunch of webinars that we can point you to come up to speed. Another thing I'm very passionate about is the Carbon Reduction Challenge, which really illustrates how students can make a difference. In this case, student teams partnering with local organizations to reduce carbon emissions, very large-scale energy efficiency projects, basically. And our last cohorts are in the tens of millions of pounds of carbon reduction, which is basically the equivalent of running dozens of homes fully solar for decades. So these are large-scale impacts that students are achieving, and I'm really happy to be a part of this and to set forth a new generation of climate solvers. And last but not least, I wanted to talk about our project with adaptation along the coast, which really is about recognizing the acute flooding that is, pressing on the Georgia coast today and will get worse going forward. This is data from the National Weather Service, just depicting that categories of major floods have increased dramatically over recent years, and residents are feeling this on their skin, and it's a kind of an immediate threat to lives and livelihoods. And of course, we just escaped Hurricane Isaias with a skirmish along the Georgia coast, but every year we have hurricanes that are threatening the coast. We have a project called Smart Sea Level Sensors, which installs a network of internet-enabled low-cost water level sensors across the vulnerable coastal area. And I'm not gonna go into this too much, but you can visit our website there. We have a lot of talks, interns, we have educational programs focused on forecasting, providing real-time data to emergency managers and responders, and also that community awareness and engagement piece, which is a huge part of what we do, focused on not just this generation, but the next as well. This is the map of the highest density sea level sensor network in the world, located in Savannah, Georgia, of all places. So we're really proud to be opening new conversations there, proud of the partnerships we have with the City of Savannah and Chatham Emergency Management Agency. Educational programs are included in here. If you are a teacher or know a teacher, we have a middle school curriculum that is plug and play for sixth grade, and you can check that out using the sensor streams. So I want to close with this. This is the way I close most of my talks these days. It reminds me how lucky we are to be alive right now, that this is happening on our watch, and our choices, both individual and collective, and our votes, both individual and collective, will determine the course of the planet for millennia to come. Thank you very much.
Wow. Boy, talk about covering a lot of ground quickly, Dr. Cobb. Thank you so much. Flannery, what kind of questions do we have in the chat so far, Flannery?
All right. So one person is starting off with a sort of technical question. Ted is wondering, is there any way to reduce emissions 50% by 2030 without a carbon tax?
50% by 2030. I mean, that's a very tall order. To reduce them by 50% is coming very close to achieving, net zero emissions, given that roughly 50% of our emissions are sucked back down to the earth. So I would say, is it technically achievable? It really depends. I will give you the example from Georgia, which I can speak to based on the research that we have done in Georgia. And maybe this is something that would help you understand the magnitude of the challenge ahead, but also the opportunities ahead. Drawdown Georgia's research results show us that we can achieve carbon neutrality in Georgia by 2030, even without a price on carbon, depending on the appetite for policies that would include retrofitting, building out solar farms, which is a major category, the incentives that may or may not be put in place for EVs and rooftop solar, how we manage our forests. Are we have an appetite for sustainable forestry that can aid in the built environment and reduce emissions in that category? So one of the exciting outcomes from Drawdown Georgia is to be able to put a price in there and see it accelerate further, or leave a price out and try to point policymakers to policy instruments that don't rely necessarily on a price on carbon, but that could be bundled together for maximum impact. So this is Georgia we're talking about, very carbon intensive state right now. Little appetite for a carbon tax, although there are some preliminary rumblings underway, especially when you think about our pine sector and that sustainable forestry piece. that a lot of people are really eager to recoup some additional revenue from over the next decade in emerging carbon markets internationally. So stay tuned. I do think it's technically possible, but I for one don't want that future. I want a future where we have a price on carbon because we need to go faster. The faster we can go, the quicker we'll get this done, and then less damage we will accrue with climate change impacts. That's the take home.
Great, thank you. So we have a lot of questions about the coral reef subject. One person is asking, can you just remind us of why coral reef destruction is important? They mentioned the world food supply from the oceans, but I imagine there are other reasons. Can you just speak to their value in the ecosystem, I guess?
Yeah, so, you know, it's important to remember that coral reefs provide, you know, the only protein source for many, many vulnerable populations living across the equator. And so I forget the exact statistic, but it's a lot of people, I think approaching up to a billion people that rely on protein sources from coral reefs right now is their only protein source. And so when we have degraded reefs, we start to have those kinds of trickle on impacts across the food supply for vulnerable communities. But we also have to recognize that the entire ocean ecosystem really depends on coral reefs being intact and healthy, serving as nurseries for much larger species of fish that play critical roles in ecosystems far and wide across the entire ocean basin. And so it's really unthinkable for marine scientists and oceanographers like myself to think of a world where coral reefs are so severely degraded like those projections show. We know that the ocean will be reworked in fundamental ways, and those are not going to benefit any aspect of the many ecosystem services that the ocean currently provides us, not just food, but also, you know, things like drug discovery, things like ocean economies, tourism industries across many vulnerable independent nations and states. And so this is a vast web that is interconnected, much of it going back to the critical role that reefs play in our ocean ecosystem and in core functions.
Great, thank you. So we have one question here about your air quality monitoring work. Someone I think is familiar with your work. This is Dana Nucitelli in the chat, actually.
All right. Hi, Dana.
Yes. And he's asking about your air quality monitoring work with Harambe House. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. And so thank you for the opener, Dana. Appreciate that. As I didn't have time to talk about this, but it's an area of intense focus right now. And so as I mentioned, that the Southeast is really home to really acutely vulnerable communities. We're talking about climate change impacts that are happening now and over the next decades, but we're also talking about communities that are facing and have faced historically really acute environmental threats related to any number of aspects of our fossil fuel infrastructure in particular. And so part of that is acute exposure to poor air quality over a very, very long time period. And so in thinking about what we can do to partner with really amazing bright lights in the environmental justice community across the Southeast, we are really thrilled to be partnering with an organization called the Harambe House, which is led by one of my icons, Dr. Mildred McLean. And she has really helped us understand that to think about water level and heat extremes, which are some of the things that I obsess with as a climate scientist that I know are now and future threats, she's helped us understand that the other current threats that they're facing related to our fossil fuel infrastructure, like air quality, water quality, is something that must be a here and now issue in our partnership. And so with that in mind, we have layered up a network of low-cost air quality sensors across these very vulnerable neighborhoods and are incorporating that into schools in terms of their infrastructure, but also into the classrooms and how they're using those data streams to understand what they can do to mitigate their own vulnerability, but also how they can work with city planners and decision makers to mitigate some of those exposure risks and kind of learn about how to use data to make claims in this space. So this is outside my area, as you can tell, as an oceanographer, but this is the kind of growth that I am excited to undertake in combination with civil engineers, air quality experts, and social scientists and K-12 folks, sensor geeks, the whole nine yards in this extremely comprehensive and ambitious project to partner deeply and in a very lasting way with environmental justice communities across the Southeast.
That's wonderful. And we have a few questions. People are wondering about where they can find the middle school curriculum that you mentioned, the sixth grade.
You go to sikora.org, let me see if I can just, I don't have it in this presentation, but if you go to, I'm gonna drop it in the chat and maybe somebody could pick it up. But if you go to sikora.org, and then you look for the education link at the top, then you will find it there under middle school curriculum. I can also send it to the CCL folks and maybe they can include some of this material in a follow-on communication.
That's great. Thank you, Kim. Mark, do we have time for more? I don't want to...
Yes, we do have time for one more, and I'm super happy now that I can call Dana Nujicelli a sensor geek. I've been wondering for the right title for him, and thank you for finally giving that to me.
Okay, last question. We have a few in the area. People are appreciating what you shared about your own individual actions and wondering how has that affected the people around you? Are people... your students or your colleagues, are they taking notice of that? Is that helping prompt change in others too?
Definitely. So that's one of the things that I've noticed with some of these individual actions that really feel very small, frankly speaking. With the examples of the biking to work, not just the people that are, quote, converted in my immediate sphere, and there are quite a few of those people, including my own husband. Eventually, he couldn't resist. But also, friends and family in a larger sphere. But the solar panels has been quite amazing. And the research supports this, too, that when you have people that are part of a peer group, and you have somebody making that kind of choice and being vocal about why and talking about the benefits and the costs and how they weighed that and talking about its longer term function. I've had over 20 different conversations about my panels that have resulted in about that number of installations and rooftop solar. So, this is again, peer reviewed research, which shows the role of the individual in these networks can be quite strong. And so this really goes back to when you are on a path of individual action, the way to think about these ripple on effects is to make sure you're talking about it. And of course, Catherine Hayhoe is very, very effective at reminding us how important it is to keep talking about climate and what it means to you and what you're doing about it, how you're engaging for solutions and whatever it is, whatever stripe you take in terms of how you bring climate solutions home to you, please talk about that because that's where your passion and your energy are going to drive other people to reflect on how they could become part of the solution. So my road is not your road, but I hope to unveil a road where you see that no matter what you do, when you talk about it, you're going to have lasting and kind of scalable impacts and that cannot be discounted, even though we need a federal price on carbon.
Wow, Dr. Cobb, thank you so much. Thank you for not just the great information, but for modeling what we all kind of aspire to be as people who are, solutions oriented, making things happen, not just dealing with the broad problem, but being an example in our own life and then sharing that with people. That was fantastic. I know it's a Saturday afternoon in August, so if you want to stay on for the next 10 minutes, you're welcome to, but I can understand that your time is pressing with four
happy
children.
Happy to stick around. I'd love to be a monthly part of this community myself, so this is a great opportunity.
Wow. We'd be honored. Great. Okay, good. Well, so then here's what we're recommending everybody do this month. First of all, every single time I go to our homepage or our website and it says, our solution to climate change, democracy, it still lights me up. And that's really what our first action is around for this month, which is voting. there's nothing more fundamental to a democracy than voting. So we give you three possible options. You could do one or all of them. One is you could partner with the Environmental Voter Project. Two is you could help students vote. I would suspect that almost everybody on this call has an ingrained habit that if you know there's going to be an election, you're going to vote. What we want to do is have as many Americans as possible have that same habit. Election comes up, they're going to vote. And option three is something you might want to do locally in your community. The second action is our monthly calling campaign. So a lot of you know that in March, we said we wanted to give Congress time to deal with the COVID. We wanted to give it time to deal with the economic crisis, but that time's passed. And we want to make sure that Congress is well aware. We want a solution. We want bipartisan solutions. So we want you to make sure that your groups are reaching out and calling members of Congress on a regular basis, both your member of the House and your senator. So if you would reinstitute that program, if you haven't already, that would be fantastic. And then the third thing is you're invited to participate in a thunderclap on August 12th. Now, I want to speak to the parents and grandparents for just a second. Please tell your kids and grandkids that you're going to participate in a thunderclap. They might think you're cool for like a couple of seconds, and then they'll get back to treating you the way they've always treated you. But essentially, a thunderclap is you retweeting what young people will be tweeting about climate action on August 12th, and you're all welcome to be part of that. Okay, so I want to talk about now till the end of the year. So in June, we had our June conference. We did it virtually. We had over 400 meetings. And it doesn't actually surprise me that for this group of people, many of you took the opportunity to be in a virtual world and make it even a better lobby meeting. You know, a lot of people these days, I don't know about in your world, but in my world, a lot of people complain about, I have too much Zoom time. We're going to have a lot more. I don't know what the upside is to complaining about it. But a lot of you actually found a way to invite community leaders in and faith leaders, people who ordinarily wouldn't have been able to go to DC with us to have a meeting, so it actually enhanced the meetings. So what are some of the things that came out of the lobby meetings in June? Well, there's two new sponsors to the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. And probably more important, there's 62 co-sponsors to our secondary asks. So we had several other bills that we had as a secondary asks in June. That included the Use It Act, the Reclaim Act, the Growing Climate Solutions Act, the BEST Act. And so now there's 62 sponsors, over 20% of which are Republicans. So in addition to getting in a couple of additional sponsors on HR 763, enormous progress on those bills. And I think particularly important that there were 20% of those being Republican. Okay, what about from now till the end of the year? So next month's speaker is Tina Johnson, who's the director of the National Black Environmental Justice Network. So she is the director for an organization called the National Black Environmental Justice Network. We're excited about having Tina on the call. The following month is Alex Posner for Students for Carbon Dividends. They've had enormous progress in getting campuses working on carbon dividends. And so we want to hear from Alex Posner and Students for Carbon Dividends. What do we want you and I to focus on between now and the election and the end of the year to make sure that a price on carbon is part of any climate package? One, if your member is already on the Energy Innovation Act, we would like you to go back to them and ask them to recommit to the bill when it gets resubmitted next year. If they have any questions about if there's going to be any changes, they should go directly to Mr. Deutsch's office. But what we would like you to do is to ask anybody who's already on the bill if they will commit to being on the bill when it gets reintroduced next year. Also, ask them if they would please ask leadership to make sure that a price is included in any climate package. So if you could do that with people who are already on the bill. There's also lots of endorsements from all kinds of sectors that you've generated over the last couple of years. What we would like to do is go back to those people and ask them to make additional statements. That could be reaching out and having calls with members of the House or Senate. It could be letters to the editor or op-eds. It could be just something that they say publicly but we're asking everybody who's already spoken out on the bill to speak out on it again. What we want to do is everything that's in our ability to affect, to have both members and people who've spoken out make sure that a carbon price was part of a package for next year. You know, we just hit our 100th municipal resolution. So thank you all for those of you who've actually gone to work with your local city to make sure that your city is speaking up in favor of the bill. Those 100 resolutions total populations of more than 21,506,929 people. So thank you all for that. We want individuals, we want groups to continue to speak up. I know a lot of you have been asking, could we kind of sneak the bill language into one of the stimulus packages? So the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act is about a $3 trillion endeavor. The stimulus package that the House has been talking about is about a $3 trillion package. The Senate's been talking about a $1 trillion. So we don't think we'd be able to sneak something like that in there. It would be great if we could, but it's unlikely that something of that size is going to be just a, oh, we got this as a side. We do believe we're going to have to get it as a standalone piece of legislation, and we're working hard to make sure that that happens. Okay, so in December, we'll be back together. December 5th and 6th, we'll be having our end of year lobby day. We've in the past done that in November. We thought with mail-in ballots, et cetera, that this year we would wait a little bit longer and wait till the first weekend in December. But then why not wait longer? Why not wait till January, for instance? Well, we want to make sure that as soon as we know who's in the new Congress, we're the first voice they hear, and the dust is settled, we know how the election worked out. We wanna make sure that we're the first or one of the first voices that they hear about what needs to happen with climate change legislation. So you'll be getting a lot of information on that soon. Hold that first weekend in December in your calendar for now, and we'll be getting information out to you soon. So thank you all for everything you're doing. Dr. Cobb, wow, that was fantastic. So great to have you on the call. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you in a month. Bye, everybody.